I saw one. Natalie looked very surprised and glanced at Byron. That's sweet of you, Sloat, but I wouldn't dream of it.
We'll find something, Byron said, shaking his head.
Oh, but his place is out of the Arabian Nights, said Natalie, adding very casually, I had a drink there last night. Would you do such a thing for us, old Sloat?
Leslie can stay with me, Thurston said. No problem at all. Pick me up at the legation, Les. I have to rush there now.
It's all set, said Sloat. While you two visit the submarine, I'll go to the hotel and clear out.
Bless you. Thank you. My bags, said Natalie distractedly. They're in Mrs. Rosen's room. Maybe I should get them.
No, I have things to throw in. I'll get them later.
Thanks, Sloat. And you too, Bunky. Thanks for everything.
Sloat signaled at a passing taxicab.
Good luck.
Natalie was astonished at the small size of the submarine, at its ugliness, and at its rustiness.
Good heavens! She shouted over the clanks and squeals of the crane moving overhead as they got out of the cab. Is that the S-45? Briny, honestly, don't you get claustrophobia when you dive in that thing?
He's never stayed awake long enough to find out, said Astor.
They were walking toward a gangway that was only a couple of planks nailed together. Sailors lounged on the low, flat, black forecastle, staring at the girl in white with an armful of roses.
One day when we're submerged, he'll open his eyes and begin screaming.
I don't mind anything but the low company, said Byron, and the body odors. It's especially marked among the senior officers. When I sleep, I don't notice it. A young, tousle-headed sailor at the gangway, wearing a gun slung low on his hip, saluted Astor, gave Natalie a yearning, respectful glance, and said,
Captain wants you all to wait for him on the dock, sir.
Very well. Soon a figure in a blue uniform, with the gold stripes of a lieutenant, emerged from the rust-streaked black sail, a housing that rose amidships over the conning tower, and crossed the gangplank to the dock. The captain was shaped rather like his submarine, clumsily thick in the middle and tapering abruptly to either end. He had big brown eyes, a broad nose, and a surprisingly boyish face.
Captain Caruso, this is my wife, said Byron, jolting Natalie with the word.
Caruso took her hand in a white, fat paw.
Well, congratulations. Byron's a good lad, in his short, conscious intervals.
Do you really sleep that much? Natalie laughed at Byron.
It's pure slander. I seldom close my eyes on this boat, said Byron, except to meditate on my folly in going to sub-school. That, I admit, I do frequently.
18 hours at a stretch he can meditate, said Astor. That's solid gold meditating.
Two sailors in dungarees came up out of an open hatch on the forecastle and crossed the gangway, one carrying a bottle of champagne in an ice bucket, the other a tray of water glasses.
Ah, here we go. Navy regs don't allow us to consume spirituous liquors on board, Mrs. Henry, said the captain,
and again she felt the little joyous jolt. He popped the cork and ceremoniously poured as the sailor held out one glass after another.
To your happiness, he shouted, as the crane went by overhead with a wild clanging.
To you, God bless you, yelled Natalie, for bringing him here.
To number two engine, bellowed Lady Astor, to the evaporators, the exhaust system, and the forward battery. Never has there been such a massive breakdown on a naval vessel.
Byron silently lifted his glass to his captain and executive officer. They drank. The crane rumbled away.
Captain, said Lady Astor, as Caruso refilled the glasses, do you think that picture in Byron's room does Natalie justice?
Not in the least, said the captain, looking at her with liquid woman-loving Italian eyes. It doesn't begin to.
That's how I feel. Now that you've actually seen her, sir, don't you agree with me that what has to be done in Lisbon may take at least 5 days?
3,
snapped Captain Caruso, the dreamy look vanishing.
Exactly 72 hours.
Aye, aye, sir.
And you'd better produce some damned convincing malfunction reports, lady.
The captain tossed off his wine and smiled at Natalie.
Now, can I offer you the hospitality of the boat for a little while?
She followed the officers into the rusty sail and down a hatch. The ladder was cold and greasy, with narrow slippery rungs that caught at Natalie's high heels. She had to lower herself through a second round hatch and down another ladder into a tiny room full of machinery, strongly conscious of her exposed legs, and glad that they were pretty and that her skirt was narrow. "This is the control room," Byron said, helping her down. Up above was the conning tower. Natalie looked around at solemn-faced sailors in dungarees and at the valves, knobs, dials, handles, big wheels, twisted cables, and panels of lights filling all the green-painted bulkheads. Despite a humming exhaust blower, the close, warm air smelled sourly of machinery, cooking, old cigars, and unwashed men.
"Briny, do you really know what all these things are?"
"He's learning," said Lady Astor, "between hibernations."
They stepped through an open, watertight door to the tiny ward room, where Natalie met two more young officers. On the table stood a heart-shaped white cake, iced in blue with a submarine, cupids, and Mr. and Mrs. Byron Henry. She squeezed herself into the place of honor at the head of the table, opposite the captain. Byron and Lady Astor sat crouched against the bulkhead, to avoid a bunk folded back over their heads. Somebody produced a sword. Natalie cut up the cake, and the captain sent what was left to the crew's quarters. The 2 glasses of champagne were going to Natalie's head. She was half dizzy anyway from the rush of events and the longing that blazed at her from the young men's eyes. Over the coffee and cake, she laughed and laughed at Lady Astor's jokes and decided that the old submarine, for all its cramped squalor, its reek of machinery and male bodies, was a mighty jolly vessel. Byron looked more desirable to her by the minute, and she kissed him often. Before they left the S-45, Byron took his bride to a tiny cabin and showed her the narrow black aperture near the deck beneath 2 other bunks where he slept.
"I ask you," he said, "would anybody spend extra time in that morgue slot through choice?"
"The alternative might be more frightful," said Lady Astor over Natalie's shoulder. "Like staying awake."
When Natalie and Byron came out on deck into cool, fresh air, crewmen on the forecastle waved and cheered. Natalie waved back, and some bold sailors whistled. The taxicab, called by the gangway watch for them, started off with a great clatter. The driver jammed on his brakes, jumped out, and soon Natalie and Byron heard him cursing in Portuguese as he threw aside shoes and tin cans. The crew laughed and yelled until the cab drove away.
"I dare say poor Sloat's left the hotel by now," Natalie snuggled against her husband. "We'll collect my bags and go there, right? Wait till you see it. It was terrible of me to jump at it like that, but honestly, Briny, it's the royal suite."
In Natalie's room in a boarding house on a side street, an old woman snored in an iron bed.
"Well, Sloat's place must be better than this," Byron whispered, glancing at the cracked ceiling and at the roaches on the peeling wallpaper, scurrying to hide from the electric light.
Natalie swiftly gathered her things and left a note with her key on the table. At the door, she turned to look at Mrs. Rosen, lying on her back, jaw hanging open, gray hair tumbled on the pillow. What kind of wedding night had Mrs. Rosen had, she thought.
with the husband whose silver-framed face smiled brownly on her bedside table, her one memento of the wretched man dragged off a French train by Germans. Natalie shivered and closed the door. The desk clerk at the Palace Hotel evidently had been informed and tipped by Sloat, for he yielded up the key to Byron with a greasy grin. The newlyweds had to give him their passports. Natalie felt a touch of fear handing over the maroon American booklet that set her off from Lisbon's 40,000 other Jews. "I just thought of something," she said in the elevator. "How did you register?"
"Mr. and Mrs., naturally. Big thrill."
"I'm still Natalie Jastro on that passport."
"So you are."
The elevator stopped. He took her arm.
"I wouldn't worry about it."
"But maybe you should go back and explain."
"Let them ask a question first."
As the bellboy opened the door to the suite, Natalie felt herself whisked off her feet.
"Oh, Byron, stop this nonsense. I'm monstrously heavy. You'll slip a disc."
But she clung to his neck with one hand and clutched her skirt with the other, excited by his surprising lean strength.
"Hey," he said, carrying her inside. "I see what you meant. Royal suite is right."
When he put her down, she darted ahead into the bedroom. Natalie had a slight nag of worry about the negligee she had left hanging in Sloat's bathroom and the new sexy underwear in a bureau drawer. It might take some explaining. But all the stuff was gone. Where, she had no idea. She was puzzling over this when Byron appeared in the French window of the bedroom on the balcony.
"This is great out here, all right. Cold as hell, though. Fabulous string of lights along the water. Did you notice the champagne and the lilies?"
"Lilies? In there." In a corner of the living room, beside champagne in a silver cooler on a marble table, stood a bouquet of red and white calla lilies, and beside them, Sloat's small white card, with no writing. The doorbell rang. A bellboy gave Natalie a box from the lingerie shop. She hurried into the bedroom and opened it. There lay the underclothes Sloat had cleared out, a many-colored froth of silk and lace.
"What's that?" Byron said from the balcony.
"Oh, some stuff I bought in a lobby shop," Natalie said airily. "I guess Sloat told them I'd be here."
She picked up a peach nightgown and with mock witchery draped it against her bosom.
"Not bad for an academic type, eh?"
Then she saw a note in Sloat's handwriting, lying under the silks. Byron started to come in. She ran for the French door and shut it on him.
"Give me a minute. Open the champagne."
The note read, "Wear the gray, Jastro. You always looked angelic in gray. Confidential communication, to be destroyed. Yours till death. Sloat." The words brought a mist to Natalie's eyes. She tore the note to bits and dropped them in a wastebasket. In the next room, she heard a cork pop. She pulled from the box the gray silk nightdress laced and trimmed in black, and quite forgot Leslie Sloat as she speedily showered and perfumed herself. She emerged from the bedroom, brushing her long black hair down on her shoulders. Byron seized her. Wine, lilies, and roses, the dark sea rolling beyond the windows under a round moon. Young lovers, separated for half a year, joined on a knife edge of geography between war and peace, suddenly married, far from home. Isolated, making love on a broad hospital bed, performing secret rites as old as time, but forever fresh and sweet between young lovers. The best moments human existence offers, such was their wedding night. The human predicament sometimes seems a gloomy tapestry with an indistinct, baffling design that swirls around and inward to brilliant, naked lovers. The Bible starts with this centerpiece. Most of the old stories end with the lovers married, retiring to their sacred nakedness. but for Byron and Natalie, their story was just beginning. The lavish pulses and streams of love died into the warm, deep sleep of exhausted lovers. Mr. and Mrs. Byron Henry, Americans, slumbering in wedlock in the Palace Hotel outside Lisbon on a January night of 1941. One of the more than 2,000 nights of the Second World War, when so much of mankind slept so badly. Chapter 38. Natalie opened her eyes, awakened by the warbling and chirping of birds. Byron sat beside her, smoking. A cool breeze was blowing from an open door to the balcony. In a pink-streaked sky, the wan moon and one star hung low over the choppy sea.
"Hi. Listen to those birds. How long have you been awake, Byron?"
"Not long, but I'm really wide awake. Wide awake and still trying to believe it." She sat up. The bedclothes slipped from her breasts as she kissed him softly, sighing with satiated pleasure.
"Gosh, that air's icy, isn't it?"
"I can close the door."
"No, no, the sea smell is lovely."
She pulled the blanket to her neck, nestling beside him. After a silence, she said,
"Byron, how does a submarine work?"
He glanced down at her. His arm was around her, caressing her shoulder.
"Are you kidding?"
"No. Is it hard to explain?"
"Not at all, but why talk about that?"
"Because I want to know."
"Well, it's a hell of a topic to take up with a beautiful naked girl, but okay. I'll tell you how a submarine works. To begin with, it's built so that it just about floats when ballasted. So when you flood the diving tanks with a few tons of seawater, you go right down. And when you blow the water out with compressed air, you pop up again. You begin with marginal buoyancy, and by changing the water ballast, you become a rock or a cork, as desired. That's the general idea. The details are numerous and dull."
"Well, is it safe? How much have I got to worry about?"
"Less than if I were a New York traffic cop."
"You get hazardous duty pay."
"That's because civilians, like congressmen and you yourself, have the illusion that it's scary and risky to dive a boat under the water. No submariner will ever argue Congress out of that."
"But when you go deep, isn't there quite a risk of being crushed?"
"No. A sub's just a long, watertight steel tube, braced to hold off sea pressure. That's the inner hull, the pressure hull. It's a real ship. The outside that you see is just a skin for tanks, open at the bottom. The water sloshes in and out. The inner hull has a test pressure depth. You can never submerge near that. Nobody to this day knows how deep the old S-45 can go. We ride on a thick cushion of safety."
"Submarines have been lost."
"So have ocean liners and sailing yachts. When men are trapped in a hull on the ocean bottom, tapping out Morse code, it makes a good story, but it's only happened a couple of times. Even then, there are ways of escaping, and we're all trained in them."
"But when you flood the boat to go down, can't the flooding get out of hand? Don't smile, darling. It's all a mystery to somebody like me."
"I smile because you ask good questions. But as I told you, the main tanks are outside the real hull. They're just stuck on. When they flood, you're awash, waterlogged. For diving, there's a small sealed tank inside, the negative tank. It can hold about 12 tons of seawater. Flood negative, and you go down fast. When you're at the depth you want, you blow negative, and there you are, hanging. You spread your bow planes, and you're sort of like a fat airplane flying slowly through thick air. Submariners are picked men and great guys, darling, and all 75 of them dearly want nothing to go wrong. There are no slobs on a submarine.
That's the truth about submarines. And this is one peculiar conversation to be having in bed with a new wife. Natalie yawned. You're making me feel better. That rusty little boat scared me.
The new fleet submarines are luxury liners compared to the S-45, Byron said. I'll go to one of those next.
She yawned again as a patch of pink light appeared on the wall.
Bless my soul, is that the sun? Where did the night go? Draw the curtains.
Byron walked naked to the windows and closed the heavy draperies. As he returned to her in the gloom, she thought with piercing pleasure how handsome he was. A sculptured male figure, alive, warm, and brown. He settled beside her. She leaned over him and gave him a kiss. When the young husband strongly pulled her close, she pretended for a moment to fight him off, but she couldn't choke down her welling, joyous laughter. As the sun rose outside the screening curtains on another day of war, Byron and Natalie Henry went back to lovemaking. They breakfasted at noon in the sunny sitting room, where the air was heavy with the scent of roses. Their breakfast was oysters, steak, and red wine. Natalie ordered it, saying it was precisely what she wanted, and Byron called it a perfect menu. They ate in dressing gowns, not talking much, looking deep in each other's eyes, sometimes laughing at a foolish word or at nothing at all. They were radiant with shared, gratified desire. Then she said, Byron, exactly how much time do we have?
Well, 72 hours from the time we came alongside would be 2:30, Thursday.
Some of the pure gladness in her eyes dimmed.
That's soon. Short honeymoon.
This isn't our honeymoon. I'm entitled to 20 days' leave. I reported straight to the S-45 from subschool. I'll take those 20 days once you're back home.
When will that be?
She leaned her head on her hand.
Oh, dear, must I start thinking?
Look, Natalie, why not send Aaron a wire that we're married and go straight home?
I can't do that. I don't want you going back to Italy.
Natalie raised her eyebrows at his flat tone.
But I have to.
No, you don't. Aaron's too cute, Byron said.
Here, let's finish this wine.
As long as you or I or somebody will do the correspondence and dig in the library and keep after the kitchen, the gardeners, and the plumbers, he won't leave that house. It's that simple. He loves it, and he doesn't scare easily.
He's a tough little bird, Uncle Aaron, under the helplessness and the head colds. What do you suppose he'd do if you sent him that wire?
Natalie hesitated.
Try to get me to change my mind. If that failed, make a real effort to leave.
Then it's the best favor you can do him.
No, he'd make a mess of it. He's not good with officials, and the stupider they are, the worse he gets. He could really trap himself.
Leslie Sloat and I together can get him on his way in short order, and this time we'll do it.
Sloat? Sloat's en route to Moscow.
He's offered to stop off in Rome and Siena first. He's very devoted to Aaron.
I know who he's devoted to.
Natalie said softly, with a poignant look,
Jealous of Leslie Sloat, Briny?
All right. 60 days.
What, dear?
Go back there for 2 months. No more. That should be plenty. If Aaron's not out by April 1st or before, it'll be his own doing, and you come home. Book your own transportation right now.
Natalie's wide mouth curved wryly.
I see. Are you giving me orders, Byron?
Yes.
She rested her chin on her palm, contemplating him with surprised eyes.
You know, that feels pretty good, being ordered around. I can't say why.
Possibly the delicious novelty will wear off. Anyway, Lord and Master, I'll do as you say. 60 days.
All right, Byron said.
Let's get dressed and see Lisbon.
I've seen Lisbon, said Natalie, but I'm all in favor of coming up for air.
Dropping the key at the desk, Byron asked for their passports. With a heavy-lidded look, the swarthy short clerk disappeared through a door.
"Look at those fellows," Byron said.
Half a dozen Germans in belted black raincoats, despite the sunshine, were talking together near the lobby entrance, looking hard at everybody who came in and went out.
They might as well be wearing boots and swastikas. What is it about them? Those raincoats? The big brims on the hats? The bronze sunburns? How do they find time for sunbathing?
I recognize them with the back of my neck. It crawls, Natalie said.
The desk clerk emerged from the door, busily shuffling papers.
Sorry, passport's not ready yet.
I need mine.
Natalie's tone was strident. The clerk barely lifted his eyes at her.
Maybe this afternoon, madam, he said, turning his back.
After the languors of the bedroom, the cold, sunny outdoors felt bracing. Byron hired a taxi to drive them into and around Lisbon. The city was no Rome or Paris for sights, but the rows of pastel-colored houses, green, pink, blue, perched along the hills above a broad river, made a pretty picture. Byron enjoyed himself, and he thought his bride was having fun, too. She clung to his arm and smiled, saying little. The peculiar mixture of Moorish and Gothic styles in the churches and in the great fortress commanding the city's highest hill brought back to Byron his dead-and-gone fine arts drudgery. They left a cab to descend arm in arm the steep, narrow, extremely small streets of the Alfama, where ragged children swarmed in and out of cracking, crazy houses hundreds of years old, and open shops the size of telephone booths sold fish, bread, and meat scraps. It was a long, wandering walk.
"Where did the cab promise to meet us?"
Natalie spoke up in a strained tone as they traversed an alley where the stinks made them gasp.
"Everything all right?" he said.
She wearily smiled.
"At the risk of sounding like every stupid woman tourist in the world, my feet hurt."
"Why, let's go back. I've had plenty of this.
Do you mind?"
She said not a word as they drove along the river road back to the hotel. When he took her hand, it was clammy. Entering the hotel, she pulled at his elbow.
"Don't forget, passports."
It proved unnecessary. With the key, the desk clerk, showing large yellow false teeth in an empty grin, handed him two maroon booklets. Natalie snatched hers and riffled through it as they walked to the elevator.
"Okay," he said.
"Seems to be, but I'll bet anything the Gestapo's photographed it, and yours, too."
"Well, it's probably routine in this hotel. I don't think the Portuguese are denying the Germans much nowadays. But what do you care?"
When she went into the bedroom of the suite to put away her coat and hat, Byron followed, took her in his arms, and kissed her. She responded, held him close, but her manner was apathetic. He leaned back with a questioning look.
"Sorry," she said. "I have a thundering headache. Burgundy for breakfast may not be just the thing after all. Luckily, I have some high-powered pills for this. Just let me take one."
Soon she came back from the bathroom, smiling.
"Okay, proceed,"
he said. "It couldn't work that fast."
"Oh, it will, don't worry."
They kissed, they lay on the bed. Byron was on fire to make love and tried to please her, but it was as though a spring had broken in Natalie. She whispered endearments and tried to be loving. After a while, he sat up and gently raised her.
"All right, what is it?"
She crouched against the head of the bed, hugging her knees.
"Nothing, nothing. What am I doing wrong? Maybe I'm a little tired. The headache's not gone yet."
"Natalie."
He took her hand, kissed it,
and looked straight into her eyes. "Oh, I guess nobody can experience such joy without paying, that's all. If you must know, I've been in a black hole all afternoon. It started when we didn't get our passports back, and those Germans were standing there in the lobby. I got this horrible sinking feeling. All the time we were sightseeing, I was having panicky fantasies. The hotel would keep stalling about my passport, and you'd sail away in the submarine, and here I'd be, just one more Jew stuck in Lisbon without papers. Natalie, you never turned a hair all through Poland. You've got your passport back now.
I know. It's sheer nonsense, just nervous depletion. Too many wonderful things happening too fast. I'll get over it.
He caressed her hair. You fooled me. I thought you were enjoying Lisbon.
I loathe Lisbon, Briny. I always have. I swear to God, whatever else happens, I'll regret to my dying day that we married and spent our wedding night here. It's a sad, painful city. You see it with different eyes, I know. You keep saying it looks like San Francisco. But San Francisco isn't full of Jews fleeing the Germans. The Inquisition didn't baptize Jews by force in San Francisco and burn the ones who objected and take away all the children to raise them as Christians. Do you know that little tidbit of history? It happened here.
Byron's face was serious. His eyes narrowed. Maybe I read it once.
Maybe. If you had, how could you forget? Anybody's blood should run cold at such cruelty. But somehow what's happened to Jews in Europe over the centuries is just a matter of course. What was Bunky's pretty phrase? Fish in a net?
Byron said, Natalie, I'll do anything you want about the religion. I've always been prepared for that. Would you want me to become Jewish?
Are you insane?
She turned her head sharply to him, and her eyes had an angry shine. She had looked like this in Königsberg, giving him a rude, abrupt goodbye.
Why did you insist on getting married? That's what's eating at me. Just tell me that. We could have made love, you know that, all you wanted. I feel tied to you now with a rope of raw nerves. I don't know where you're going. I don't know when I'll ever see you again. I only know you're sailing away Thursday in that damned submarine. Why don't we tear up those Portuguese documents? Let everything be as it was. My God, if we ever find ourselves in a human situation, and if we still care, we can get properly married. This was a farce.
No, it wasn't. It's the only thing I've wanted since I was born. Now I've got it. We're not tearing up any papers. You're my wife.
But God in heaven, why have you gone to all this trouble? Why have you put yourself in this mess?
Well, it's like this, Natalie. Married officers get extra allowances. She stared at him. Her taut face relaxed. She slowly, reluctantly smiled and thrust both her hands in his hair.
I see. Well, that makes a lot of sense, Briny. You should have told me sooner. I can understand greed.
Mouth to mouth, they fell back on the bed, and the lovemaking started to go better. But the telephone rang. It rang and rang and rang, and the kisses had to stop. Byron sighed. Could be the S-45, and picked up the receiver. Yes? Oh, hello. Right. That's thoughtful of you. 9 o'clock. Wait. He covered the mouthpiece. Thurston apologizes for intruding. He and Sloat thought we might conceivably want to have dinner in a special place. Best food in Lisbon, best singer in Portugal. Good heavens. Old Sloat is uncovering a masochistic streak. Yes or no?
As you wish.
Byron said, They mean to be nice. Why not? We have to eat. Get away from the black raincoats. He accepted, hung up, and took her in his arms.
The restaurant was a brick-walled, low room, illuminated only by table candles and the logs blazing in an arched fireplace. Jews,
many in sleek dinner clothes, filled half the tables. Two large British parties, side by side, made most of the noise in the sedate place. Directly in front of the fire, a table for six stood empty, longingly eyed by customers clustering in a small bar. The four Americans sat at another favored table near the fire. Over Portuguese white wine, Bunky Thurston and the newlyweds soon grew merry. Not Sloat. He drank a lot, but hardly spoke or smiled. The firelight glittered on his square glasses, and even in that rosy light his face looked ashen.
"I don't know if you youngsters are interested in the war, by the way," Thurston said over the meat. "Remember the war? There's news."
"If the news is good, I'm interested," Natalie said. "Only if it's good."
"Well, the British have captured Tobruk."
Natalie said, "Is Tobruk important?"
Byron exclaimed, "Important? It's the best harbor between Egypt and Tunis. That's mighty good news."
"Right," Thurston said. "They're really roaring across North Africa now. Makes the whole war look different."
Sloat broke the silence to say hoarsely, "They're fighting Italians." He cleared his throat and went on.
"Byron, did you actually read the list of books I gave you in Berlin? Natalie says you did."
"Whatever I could find in English, yes. Maybe 7 or 8 out of 10?
The diplomat shook his head.
"Extraordinary heroism."
"I don't claim I understood them all," Byron said. "Sometimes my eyes just passed over words, but I plowed on through."
"What books?" Thurston said.
"My darling here became slightly curious about the Germans," said Natalie. "After a Luftwaffe pilot almost shot his head off, he wanted to know a little more about them."
Sloat gave him a general syllabus of German 19th-century romanticism, nationalism, and idealism.
"Never dreamed he'd do anything about it," Sloat said, turning his blank, firelit glasses toward her.
"I had all this time in Siena last year," Byron said, "and I was interested."
"What did you find out?" said Thurston, refilling Byron's glass. "You couldn't get me to read German philosophy if the alternative were a firing squad."
"Mainly that Hitler's always been in the German bloodstream," Byron said, "and sooner or later had to break out. That's what Leslie told me in Berlin. He gave me the list to back up his view. I think he pretty well proved it. I used to think the Nazis had swarmed up out of the sewers and were something novel, but all their ideas, all their slogans, and practically everything they're doing is in the old books. That thing's been brewing in Germany for 100 years.
"For longer than that," Sloat said. "You've done your homework well, Byron. A+.
"Oh, balderdash," Natalie exclaimed. "A+ for what? Repeating a tired cliché? It's only novel to Byron because American education is so shallow, and because he probably didn't absorb any he got."
"Not much," Byron said. "Mostly I played cards and ping-pong."
"Well, it's very evident." His bride's tone was sharp. "Or you wouldn't have gone boring through that one-sided list of his like a blind bookworm, just to give him a chance to patronize you."
"I deny the patronizing and the one-sidedness," said Sloat. "Not that it matters, Jastrow. I guess I'll have to call you Henry now. But I think I covered the field, and I admire your hubby for tackling the job so earnestly."
"The whole thesis is banal and phony," Natalie said, "this idea that the Nazis are a culmination of German thought and culture. Hitler got his racism from Gobineau, a Frenchman, his Teutonic superiority from Chamberlain, an Englishman, and his Jew-baiting from Luger, a Viennese political thug. The only German thinker you can really link straight to Hitler is Richard Wagner. He was another mad Jew-hating socialist, and Wagner's writings are all over Mein Kampf. But Nietzsche broke with Wagner over that malignant foolishness. Nobody takes Wagner seriously as a thinker anyway.
His music disgusts me, too, though that's neither here nor there. I know you've read more in this field than I have, Sloat, and I can't imagine why you gave Byron such a dreary, loaded list. Probably just to scare him off with big names. But as you ought to know, he doesn't scare.
I'm aware of that, Sloat said. Abruptly he splashed wine into his glass, filling it to the brim, and emptied it without pausing for breath.
Your veal's getting cold, Byron said to his bride. This unexpected edgy clash between Natalie and her ex-lover was threatening to get out of hand. She tossed her head at him and impatiently cut a bit of meat, talking as she ate.
We created Hitler, more than anybody, we Americans, mainly by not joining the League, and then by passing the insane Smoot-Hawley tariff in 1930, during a deep depression, knocking over Europe's economy like a row of dominoes. After Smoot-Hawley, the German banks closed right and left. The Germans were starving and rioting. Hitler promised them jobs, law and order, and revenge for the last war. And he promised to crush the communists. The Germans swallowed his revolution to fend off a communist one. He's kept his promises, and he's held the Germans in line with terror, and that's the long and the short of it. Why, there isn't a German in a thousand who's read those books, Briney. It's all a thick cloud of university gas. Hitler's a product of American isolation and British and French cowardice, not of the ideas of Hegel and Nietzsche.
University gas is good, my dear, Sloat said, and I'll accept it. He touched his spread fingertips together, slouched in his chair, regarding her with a peculiar smile, at once superior and frustrated. In the sense that in any time and place the writings of the philosophers are a kind of exhaust gas of the evolving social machinery, a point that Hegel more or less makes, and that Marx took and vulgarized. But you can recover from an analysis of the gas what the engine must be like, and how it works, and the ideas may be powerful and true no matter how produced. German Romanticism is a terribly important and powerful critique of the way the West lives, Jastro. It faces all the nasty weaknesses.
Such as?
Her tone was mean and abrupt.
A rush of argument broke from Sloat, as though he wanted to conquer her with words in Byron's presence, if he could do nothing else. He began stabbing one finger in the air, like exclamation points, to his sentences.
Such as, my dear, that Christianity is dead and rotting since Galileo cut its throat. Such as that the ideas of the French and American revolutions are thin fairy tales about human nature. Such as that the author of the Declaration of Independence owned Negro slaves. Such as that the champions of liberty, equality, and fraternity ended up chopping off the heads of helpless women and each other's heads. The German has a very clear eye for such points, Natalie. He saw through the rot of Imperial Rome and smashed it. He saw through the rot of the Catholic Church and broke its back, and now he thinks Christian industrial democracy is a rotting sham, and he proposes to take over by force. His teachers have been telling him for a century that his turn is coming, and that cruelty and bloodshed are God's footprints in history. That's what's in the books I listed for Byron, poured out in great detail. It's a valid list. There was another strain in Germany, to be sure, a common-sense liberal humanist tendency linked with the West, the good Germany. I know all about it, Natalie. Most of its leaders went over to Bismarck, and nearly all the rest followed the Kaiser. When his time came, Hitler had a waltz. Now listen. In a solemn tone, like a priest chanting a mass, beating time in the air with a stiff finger, Sloat quoted, "The German Revolution will not prove any milder or gentler because it was preceded by the critique of Kant,
by the transcendental idealism of Fichte. These doctrines served to develop revolutionary forces that only await their time to break forth. Christianity subdued the brutal warrior passion of the Germans, but it could not quench it. When the cross, that restraining talisman, falls to pieces, then will break forth again the frantic berserker rage. The old stone gods will then arise from the forgotten ruins and wipe from their eyes the dust of centuries. Thor, with his giant hammer, will arise again, and he will shatter the Gothic cathedrals. Sloat made an awkward, weak gesture with a fist to represent a hammer blow, and went on. Smile not at the dreamer who warns you against Kantians, Fichteans, and the other philosophers. Smile not at the fantasy of one who foresees in the region of reality the same outburst of revolution that has taken place in the region of intellect. The thought precedes the deed as the lightning the thunder. German thunder is of true German character. It is not very nimble, but rumbles along somewhat slowly. But come it will, and when you hear a crashing such as never before has been heard in the world's history, then know that at last the German thunderbolt has fallen. Heine, the Jew who composed the greatest German poetry and who fell in love with German philosophy, Heine wrote that. Sloat said in a quieter tone, he wrote that 106 years ago. Behind him, chairs rasped and a party in evening clothes, cheerily chattering in German, flanked by three bobbing, ducking waiters, came to the big table by the fire. Sloat was jostled. Glancing over his shoulder, he looked straight into the face of the Gestapo chief, who amiably smiled and bowed. With him was the man with the scarred forehead they had seen in the hotel, and another German with a shaved head, and three giggling Portuguese women in bright evening dresses. End of philosophy seminar, muttered Bunky Thurston. Why? Said Byron. Because for one thing, Natalie snapped, I'm bored with it. As the Germans sat down, conversation died throughout the restaurant. The Jews were looking warily toward them. In the lull, only the boisterous and oblivious British parties sounded louder. Who are those English people? Natalie said to Thurston. Expatriates, living here because it's cheap and there's no rationing. Also, I guess, because it's out of range of Luftwaffe bombs, Thurston said. The British embassy staff isn't crazy about them. That's a remarkable quote from Heine, Byron said to Sloat. I wrote a paper on Hegel and Heine at Oxford. Sloat smiled thinly. Heine was fascinated by Hegel for a long time, then repudiated him. I translated that passage for an epigraph. The rhetoric is rather purple. So is Jeremiah's. Jewish prophets have one vein. As they were drinking coffee, a pink spotlight clove the dark room, striking a gray curtain on a little platform. Bunky Thurston said, "Here he comes. He's the best of the Fado singers." The best of what? Byron said. A pale, dark-eyed young man in a black cloak with thick fringes stepped through the curtain holding an onion-shaped guitar. Fado singers, fate songs, very pathetic, very Portuguese. At the first chords that the young man struck, strong, sharp, sad chords in a hammering rhythm, the restaurant grew still. He sang in a clear, high, florid voice, looking around with his black eyes, his high, bulging forehead pink in the spotlight. Natalie murmured to Thurston, "What song is that?" "That's an old one, the Fado of the Students." "What do the words mean?" "Oh, the words never amount to anything, just a sentence or two. That one says, 'Close your eyes,
Life is simpler with your eyes closed. The glance of the newlyweds met. Byron put his hand over Natalie's. The young man sang several songs, with strange moments of speeding up, slowing down, sobbing, and trilling. These evidently were the essence of fado, because when he performed such flourishes in the middle of a song, the Portuguese in the room applauded and sometimes cheered.
"Lovely," Natalie murmured to Bunky Thurston when a song ended. "Thank you."
He smoothed his mustache with both hands.
"I thought you'd find it agreeable. It's something different."
"Spieler, können Sie o solo mio singen?"
The shaven-headed German was addressing the singer. He sat only a few feet from the platform. Smiling uneasily, the singer replied in Portuguese, gesturing at his oddly shaped guitar, that he only performed fado songs. In a jolly tone, the German told him to sing O Solo Mio anyway. Again, the young man made helpless gestures, shaking his head. The German pointed a smoking cigar at him and shouted something in Portuguese that brought dead quiet in the restaurant, even among the British, and froze the faces of the three young women at his table. With a piteous look around at the audience, the young performer began to do O Solo Mio very badly. The German leaned back, beating time in the air with his cigar. A thick pall fell in the restaurant. Natalie said to Thurston, "Let's leave now."
"I'm for that."
The singer was still stumbling through the Italian song as they walked out. On the counter at the entrance, under a picture of him, phonograph records in paper slipcovers were piled.
"If that first song is there," Natalie said to Byron, "buy me a record."
He bought two. The streetlights outside were brighter than the illumination in the restaurant, and the wind was cutting. Leslie Sloat, tying a muffler around his neck, said to Byron, "When do you leave?"
"Not till day after tomorrow."
"Years hence, the way I'm counting time," said Natalie with a note of defiance, hugging her husband's arm. "Well, Natalie, shall I try to get us on a plane to Rome Saturday?"
"Oh, wait, maybe he won't leave. I can always hope."
"Of course." Sloat held out his hand to Byron. "If I don't see you again, congratulations, and good luck, and smooth sailing."
"Thanks, and thanks for that suite. It was brash of us to put you out of it."
"My dear fellow," said Sloat, "it was quite wasted on me."
All her limbs jerking, Natalie woke from a nightmare of Gestapo men knocking at the door. She heard real knocking in the darkness. She lay still, hoping that a trace of the nightmare was hovering in her fogged brain and that the knocking would stop. It did not. She looked at her luminous watch and touched Byron's warm, hairy leg.
"Byron! Byron!"
He raised himself on an elbow, then sat up straight.
"What time is it?"
"Quarter to two." The knocking became faster and louder. Byron jumped from the bed and slipped into a robe.
"Briny, be careful about letting anyone in. First make sure who it is."
Natalie left the warm nest of the bed and was putting on a negligee, shivering in the chilly night air, when Byron opened the bedroom door.
"It's only Aster, so don't be scared."
"What does he want?"
"That's what I'm finding out."
The door shut. Natalie went and leaned her ear against it and heard Tobruk mentioned. Humiliated at having to eavesdrop, she rattled the knob and went in. The two young men rose from the sofa where they sat hunched in talk. Lieutenant Aster, in a blue and gold uniform and white peaked cap, was eating an apple.
"Hi, Natalie. This is one terrible thing to do, breaking in on honeymooners," he said cheerily. "Talk about extra hazardous duty."
"What's the matter?"
Byron said, "Change of orders. Nothing serious or urgent. No sweat."
"Right. Matter of fact, I was just shoving off."
Lieutenant Aster dropped the apple core in a tray.
I have to round up some crew members that had overnights. It's going to be an interesting tour of Estoril and Lisbon after dark. See you, Byron. With a grin at her and a brief tip of his rakishly tilted hat, the lieutenant left.
"Well, tell me."
Natalie confronted her husband, arms folded. Byron went to the red marble fireplace and touched a match to papers under a pile of kindling and logs. "The S-45 leaves this morning."
"This very morning, eh? Too bad. Where to?"
"I don't know. The fall of Tobruk has changed the mission, which, to tell you the truth, I never exactly knew in the first place. Something about surveying submarine facilities in the Mediterranean." "Well, all right. I guess I asked for this. My entire married life, as it may yet turn out, cut short by one-third."
"Natalie, our married life starts when you get back from Italy."
He put his arm around her, and they stood watching the fire brighten. "It's going to be very long, happy, and fruitful. I plan on 6 kids. This made the young wife laugh through her gloom and put a hand to his face. "Oh, Lord, 6! I'll never last the course."
"Jiminy, that fire feels marvelous. Did we finish the wine before we went to sleep? Look and see."
He brought a glass of wine and lit a cigarette for her.
"Briny, one thing you should know. Back in November, Aaron was so sick he thought he might die. I had to take him to a specialist in Rome. It was a kidney stone. He lay in the Excelsior for 2 weeks, really in torture. Finally it cleared up. But one night, when he was very low, Aaron told me that he'd left everything he has to me. And he told me what it added up to. I was amazed."
She smiled at him, sipping her wine. Byron looked at her with slitted eyes. "I guess he's sort of a miser, like most bachelors. That's one reason he moved to Italy. He can live handsomely there on very little. Aaron's actually kept nearly all the money he made on a Jew's Jesus, and it brings in more every year. The book on Paul earned quite a bit, too. And before that, he'd saved a lot of his professor's salary. Living in Italy, he hasn't even paid taxes. Aside from the value of his house, Aaron's worth more than $100,000. He just lives on his interest. The money is invested back in New York. I had no idea of any of this, not the slightest. That he would leave anything to me never crossed my mind. Nevertheless, that's how things stand."
Natalie took Byron's chin in her hand and pushed it this way and that. "What are you so grim about? I'm telling you, you've married an heiress."
Byron poked a fallen red coal back into the fire. "Damn, he's really cute. Cuter than I thought."
"Are you being fair, especially with your plan for 6 kids?
"Possibly not."
Byron shrugged.
"Do you have enough money to get home with? You're coming home in 2 months, no matter what."
"I know, I agreed to that. I have plenty." "Phew, that fire's beginning to scorch."
She reclined on a couch before the blaze. The negligee fell away, and the light played warmly on her smooth legs.
"Briny, does your family know you intended to get married?"
"No. No sense making trouble when I wasn't sure it would come off. I did write Warren."
"Is he still in Hawaii?"
"Yes. He and Janice love it. I think you and I may well land there. The Navy keeps beefing up the Pacific Fleet. Warren thinks we'll be fighting Japan soon. That's the feeling all through the Navy."
"Not Germany?"
"No. It may sound strange to you, sitting here, but our people still don't get excited about Hitler. A few newspapers and magazines froth around, but that's about it."
He sat on the floor at her feet, looking at the fire, resting his head against her soft, uncovered thigh. She caressed his hair.
"Exactly when do you leave, and how?"
"Lady's going to come back for me at 6.
6? Why, that's hours and hours.
Big, big chunk of our marriage left to enjoy. Of course, you have to pack."
10 minutes.
Can I go with you to the boat?
I don't see why not. With a deep sigh, Natalie said, Why are you sitting on the floor? Come here. There was no dawn. The sky turned paler and paler until it was light gray. Mist and drizzle hid the sea. Lieutenant Astor picked them up in a rattling little French car. The back seat was packed with 4 glum sailors smelling of alcohol and vomit. He drove with one hand, leaning far out to work a broken windshield wiper, keeping the accelerator on the floor. The foggy road along the river was empty, and they reached Lisbon quickly. The submarine was dwarfed by a very rusty tramp steamer berthed directly ahead, with an enormous Stars and Stripes painted on its side, an American flag flying, and the name Yankee Bell stenciled in great, drippy white letters on bow and stern. Its grotesquely cut-up shape and crude riveted plating looked foreign and 30 or 40 years old. It rode so high in the water that much of its propeller and mossy red bottom showed. Jews lined the quay in the drizzle, waiting quietly to go aboard, most of them with cardboard suitcases, cloth bundles, and frayed clothes. The children, there were quite a number, stood silent, clinging to their parents. At a table by the gangway, 2 uniformed Portuguese officials, under umbrellas held by assistants, were inspecting and stamping papers. Policemen in rubber capes paced up and down the queue. The rail of the ship was black with passengers staring at the quay and the Lisbon hills, as freed prisoners look back at the jail to savor their liberty.
"When did that ocean greyhound show up?" Byron said.
"Yesterday morning. It's an old Polish bucket, and the crew are mostly Greeks and Turks," Astor said. "I've tried talking to them. The pleasanter ones seem to be professional cutthroats. I gather the Jews will be packed in like sardines in 5-decker bunks, for which they'll pay the price of deluxe suites on the Queen Mary. These fellows laughed like hell about that."
He glanced at his wristwatch.
"Well, we cast off at 07:15. Goodbye, Natalie, and good luck. You were a beautiful bride, and now you're a beautiful Navy wife."
The exec stepped aboard, smartly returning the salute of the gangway watch. On the dock near the gangway, unmindful of the rain beginning to fall, a sailor was hugging and kissing a dumpy Portuguese trollop dressed in red satin. Byron held out his arms to his wife with a glance at the sailor and a grin. She embraced him.
"You fool! Your trouble is you went and married the creature."
"I was drunk," Byron said. He kissed her again and again. A bosun's whistle blew on the submarine, and a loudspeaker croaked,
"Now station the special sea details."
"Well, I guess this is it," he said. "So long." Natalie was managing not to cry. She even smiled.
"Getting married was the right idea, my love. I mean that. It was an inspiration, and I adore you for it. I feel very married. I love you, and I'm happy."
"I love you."
Byron went aboard the submarine, saluting as he stepped on deck. In the thickening drizzle, her raincoat pulled close, her breath smoking in the damp, frigid air, Natalie stood on the dock, smelling wharfside odors, tar, machinery, fish, the sea, hearing the bleak cry of the gulls and the feeling for the first time what she had gotten herself into. She was a Navy wife, all right. 3 men in black trench coats and oversized fedora hats came strolling along the quay, calmly inspecting the refugees, who either tried to ignore them or peered at them in horror. Women pulled their children closer. The men halted near the gangway. One pulled papers from a black portfolio, and they all began talking to the officials at the table. Meanwhile, on the submarine, sailors in peacoats pulled in the gangplank. The bosun's whistle blew. The loudspeaker squawked. Appearing on the narrow little bridge in foul-weather clothes, the captain and Lieutenant Astor waved.
"Goodbye, Natalie,"
Captain Caruso called. She did not see Byron come out on the forecastle, but after a while noticed him standing near the anchor among the sailors, in a khaki uniform and a brown windbreaker, hands in his back pockets, trousers flapping in the breeze. It was the first time she had ever seen Byron in a uniform. It made him seem different, remote, and older. Astor was shouting orders through a megaphone. Colored signal flaps ran up. The sailors hauled in the lines. Byron walked along the forecastle and stood opposite his bride, almost close enough to reach out and clasp hands. She blew him a kiss. His face, under the peaked khaki cap, was businesslike and calm. A foghorn blasted. The submarine fell away from the dock, and black water opened between them.
"You come home now," he shouted.
"I will. Oh, I swear I will.
I'll be waiting. 2 months."
He went to his duty station. With a swish of water from the propellers, the low black submarine dimmed away into the drizzle.
"Craw! Craw! Craw!"
Mournfully screeching, the gulls wheeled and followed the fading wake. Natalie hurried up the quay, past the Gestapo men, past the line of escaping Jews, whose eyes were all fixed in one direction, the gangway table they still had to pass, where the Portuguese officials and the three Germans were comparing papers and laughing together. Natalie's hand sweatily clutched the American passport in her pocket.
"Hello, old Sloat," she said when she found a telephone and managed to make the connection. "This is Mrs. Byron Henry. Are you interested in buying me a breakfast? I seem to be free. Then let's push on to Italy, dear, and get Aaron out. I have to go home."
Chapter 39. In Washington, Victor Henry was reassigned to war plans. He did not hear from Roosevelt at all. People said the president was unaccountable, and from first-hand knowledge, the naval captain was beginning to believe it. But he was untroubled by the assignment, though he had craved and expected sea duty. More than anything else, more than the gray hairs beginning to show at his temples, more than the sharper lines on his forehead and around his mouth, more than his calmer pace on the tennis court, his contentment with still another desk job showed how Victor Henry was changing. Washington, in January 1941, after London and Berlin, struck him as a depressing panorama of arguments, parties, boozing, confusion, lethargy, and luxury. Ominously like Paris before the fall. It took him a long time to get used to brilliantly lit streets, rivers of cars, rich, overabundant food, and ignorant indifference to the war. The military men and their wives, when Pug talked to them, discussed only the hairline advantages that the distant explosions might bring in their own tiny lives. Navy classmates of his caliber were stepping into the major sea commands that led to flag rank. He knew he was regarded as a hard-luck guy, a comer sunk by bureaucratic mischance. But he had almost stopped caring. He cared about the war, and he cared about the future of the United States, which looked dark to him. The Navy was as preoccupied as ever by Japan. Every decision of the president to strengthen the Atlantic fleet caused angry buzzes and knowing headshakes in the department and at the Army and Navy Club. When he tried to talk about the Germans, his friends tended to regard him askance. A bypassed crank, their amused glances almost said, trying to inflate his importance by exaggerating minor matters he happened to know about. The roaring debate over Lend-Lease in Congress and the newspapers seemed to him a farrago of illogic and irrelevance.
It suited Hitler's book at the moment not to declare war on the United States. That was all. It apparently suited the American people, in turn, to fake neutrality while commencing a sluggish, grudging effort on the British side, arguing every inch of the way. These two simple facts were being lost in the storm of words. Pug Henry was content in the War Plans Division, because here he worked in another world. A secret, very small world of hard-boiled reality. Early in January, with a few other officers and war plans, he had begun conversations with British military men. In theory, Lord Burnwilk and his delegation were in Washington on vague missions of observing or purchase. Supposedly, the talks were low-level explorations binding on nobody, and supposedly the President, the Army Chief of Staff, and the Chief of Naval Operations took no cognizance of them. In fact, by the 1st of March, these conferences were finishing up a written war operations plan on a world scale. The assumption was that Japan would sooner or later attack, and the key decision of the agreement lay in two words: Germany first. It heartened Victor Henry that the American Army and Air Corps planners concurred in this, and also, to his considerable surprise and pleasure, Admiral Benton and two other naval colleagues who had thought the war through. Unlike the rest of the Navy, still rolling along in the greased grooves of the old drills and war games against Orange, the code name for Japan. It was clear to Pug Henry that if Japan entered the war with her annual steel production of only a few million tons, she could not hold out long if Germany were beaten. But if the Germans knocked out the British and got the fleet, they could go on to conquer whole continents, getting stronger as they went, whatever happened to Japan. From his conversations at the Army and Navy Club, he knew that this Germany-first decision would, if it came out, create a fearsome howl. He was one of a handful of Americans, perhaps less than 20, from the president downward, who knew about it. This was a peculiar way to run national affairs, perhaps, but to his amazement, which never quite faded, this was how things were going. To be part of this crucial, anonymous work satisfied him. It was passing strange to arrive in the morning at the drab little offices in a remote wing of the old Navy building and sit down with the British for another day of work on global combat plans, after reading in the morning papers, or hearing on the radio, yesterday's shrill lend-lease argument in Congress. Pug could not get over the cool dissembling of the few high officials who knew of the conversations. He kept wondering about a form of government which required such deviousness in its chiefs, and such soothing, cajoling fibs to get its legislators to act sensibly. Once, the planners, weary after a hammering day, sat in their shirt sleeves around a radio, listening to General Marshall testify before a Senate committee. They heard this Army Chief of Staff, whose frosty, remote uprightness made Henry think of George Washington, assure the senators that no intention existed for America to enter the war, and that at present there was no need for any large buildup of its armed forces. The planners had just been discussing an allocation of troops based on an American army of 5 million in 1943, a projection of which Marshall was well aware. "I don't know," Pug remarked to Burnwilk. "Maybe the only thing you can say for democracy is that all other forms of government are even worse."
"Worse for what?" was the Air Commodore's acid reply. "If other forms are better for winning wars, no other virtue counts."
Pug got along well with Burnwilk, who had fully grasped the landing craft problem. Among the planners, a labored joke was spreading about Captain Henry's girlfriend, Elsie. This was, in fact, a play on
LC, for landing craft, which he kept stressing as the limiting factor of operations in all theaters. Pug had worked up formulas converting any troop movement across water into types and quantities of landing craft, and these formulas threw cold water on many an ambitious and plausible plan. Somebody would usually say, "Pug's girl Elsie acting up again." And Byrne Wilk always supported his insistence on this bottleneck. Henry seldom encountered Pamela Tudsbury, whom the Air Commodore had brought along as his typist aide. Tucked in an office in the British Purchasing Mission, she evidently worked like a dog, for her face was always haggard. A glad shock had coursed through him when he first saw Pamela, standing at Byrne Wilk's elbow, regarding him with glowing eyes. She had not written that she was coming. They met for a drink just once. Pug amplified all he could on his letter about the meeting with Ted Gallard. She looked extremely young to him, and his gust of infatuation with this girl after the bombing mission seemed, in the bustling Willard Bar in Washington, a distant and hardly believable episode. Yet the hour with her was warmly pleasurable. Any day thereafter, when he saw her, was a good day for him. He left these encounters to chance. He did not telephone her, nor ask her to meet him again, and while she always acted glad to see him, she made no move to do so more often. As a college boy thinks about fame, and an exile about going home, this Navy captain of 49 once in a while mused on what a romance with the young Englishwoman might be like. But it was the merest daydreaming. He remained devoted to his wife, in his fashion. Rhoda had received her husband back with a puzzling mixture of moods, demonstrative affection, and even lust, alternating with spells of heavy gloom, coldness, and loud irascibility over her move back to Washington from New York. She leveled off to a low-temperature detachment, busying herself with bundles for Britain and her old-time music committees, and making numerous trips to New York for one reason or another. She sometimes mentioned Palmer Kirby, now one of the chairmen of Bundles for Britain, in a most casual way. Rhoda went to church with Pug and sang the hymns and relayed gossip about unfaithful Navy wives, all exactly as before. She was plainly disappointed when Pug went back to war plans instead of getting a command at sea, but they settled back into their old routines, and Pug soon was too preoccupied to worry much about Rhoda's moods, which had always been jagged. News about their children intermittently drew them together. Byron's offhand letter about his hasty marriage in Lisbon was a shock. They talked for days about it, worrying, agonizing, comforting each other, before resigning themselves to live with the fact. Warren, as usual, sent the good news. His wife was returning to Washington to have her baby, and he had been promoted to lieutenant. Pug turned 50 on a Sunday early in March. He sat in church beside his wife, trying, as he listened to the choir sing "Holy, Holy, Holy," to shake off a sense that he had missed all the right turns in life. He counted his blessings. His wife was still beautiful, still capable of love. If she had failings, what woman didn't? His two sons were naval officers. His daughter was self-supporting and clever. Perhaps his career had gone off the rails, but he was serving in a post where he was doing some good. He could not really complain. Rhoda, as she sat there beside him, was thinking mainly about the fact that her husband, for the first time since his return from abroad, would soon be meeting Palmer Kirby face to face. A snowstorm clogged the Capitol on the night of Rhoda's dinner party. By 7:15, her guests, including Kirby, had straggled in,
brushing and stamping off snow, but the dinner was still stalled. Pug was missing. In the cramped, hot kitchen of an elegant little furnished house on Tracy Place, rented from a millionaire bachelor who was now the ambassador to Brazil, Rhoda made a last-minute check of the dinner and found all in order. Soup hot, ducks tender, vegetables on the boil, cook snarling over the delay. She sailed out to her guests after a scowl in the hallway mirror and a touch at her hairdo. Rhoda wore a silvery dress molded to her figure. Her color was high, her eyes bright with nervous excitement. In the living room, Kirby and Pamela Tudsbury were talking on the big couch. Madeline and Janice had their heads together in a corner, and on facing settees before a log fire, Alastair Tudsbury and Lord Burnwilk were chatting with the recently elected Senator Lacouture and his wife. It was a hodgepodge company, but since it was only for a hurried dinner before a Bundles for Britain concert, she was not too concerned. Pug's meeting with Kirby was the chief thing on her mind. "We'll wait 10 more minutes." Rhoda sat herself beside the scientist. "Then we'll have to eat. I'm on the committee." "Where is Captain Henry?" Pamela said calmly. Her mauve dress came to a halter around her neck, leaving her slim shoulders naked. Her tawny hair was piled high on her head. Rhoda remembered Pamela Tudsbury as a mousy girl, but this was no mouse. Rhoda recognized Kirby's expression of lazy, genial appetite. "I'm blessed if I can say. Military secrecy covers a multitude of sins, doesn't it?" Rhoda laughed. "Let's hope he's working on defense and not a blonde." "I very much doubt that it's a blonde," said Pamela. "Not Captain Henry." "Oh, these goody-goody ones are the worst, my dear. That's a divine dress." "Do you like it? Thank you." Pamela adjusted the skirt. "I feel all got up for a pantomime, almost. I've been in uniform day and night for weeks." "Does Lord Burnwilk drive you that hard?" "Oh, no, Mrs. Henry. There really are masses of things to do. I feel so lucky at being in Washington that I guess I work off my guilt with the late hours." "The Waring Hotel, then, would be the best bet, Pamela." Kirby's tone took up the conversation Rhoda had broken into. "If they've repaired the bomb damage, by now they should have. The Germans went after Buckingham Palace very hard, and the whole neighborhood took quite a beating, but that was back in October."
"I'll shoot a cable to the Waring tomorrow."
"Why, Palmer, are you going to London?" said Rhoda. Kirby turned to her, crossing his legs.
"It appears so."
"Isn't that something new?"
"It's been in the works for a while."
"London! How adventurous!"
Rhoda laughed, covering her surprise.
Mrs. Lacouture's voice rose above the talk. "Janice, should you be drinking all those martinis?"
"Oh, mother," said Janice, as the white-coated old Filipino, a retired Navy steward hired by Rhoda for the evening, shakily filled the glass in her outstretched hand.
"That baby will be born with an olive in its mouth," remarked the senator.
The two Englishmen laughed heartily, and Lacouture's pink face wrinkled up with self-satisfaction.
"So you did see Byron," Janice said to Madeline. "When was this?"
"A couple of weeks ago. His submarine put in at the Brooklyn Navy Yard overnight. He took me to dinner."
"How was he?"
"He's, I don't know, more distant, almost chilly. I don't think he likes the Navy much."
"Maybe he doesn't like being married much," Janice said. "I never heard of anything so peculiar. A couple of days of whoop-de-doo in Lisbon, and back she goes to Italy, and off he chugs in his little S-boat. Why on earth did they bother to get married?"
"Well, possibly a Jewish girl would insist," Madeline said in arch tones.
Janice laughed shortly.
"That may well be. I'll say this, she's a mighty bright and pretty one."
She grimaced, moving her large stomach under her flowing green gown, trying to get more comfortable.
Ugh, what a bloated cow I am. This is what it all leads to, honey, never forget it. And how's your love life?
Oh, dear. Well, Madeline glanced toward her mother. You remember that trombone player with the big sad eyes, the one who dressed all in brown?
That communist. Oh, Madeline, don't tell me.
Oh, no, Bosie was an utter drip. But I went with him to this peace rally at Madison Square Garden. It was really something, Jan. Packed, and this gigantic red, white, and blue sign stretching clear across the garden. The Yanks are not coming.
Madeline waved her hands far apart.
And all these loyalist Spain songs and these mass chants they do, and novelists and poets and college professors making red-hot anti-war speeches and whatnot. Well, there was this other fellow in our box. He writes horror programs. He's very successful. He makes about $500 a week. And he's handsome. But he's another communist.
Madeline sneezed, blew her nose, and looked slyly at Janice.
What do you think would jolt my family more, Byron's Jewish girl or a communist?
Bob comes from Minnesota. He's a Swede, at least. He's awfully nice.
Janice said, What about that boss of yours?
Hugh Cleveland, what about him?
The two young women regarded each other. Wry, knowing wrinkles turned up the corners of Janice's mouth. Madeline colored under the rouge and powder on her pallid face.
Yes, why the grin, Janice?
She drank most of her martini.
Oh, I don't know. You keep taking up with one impossible fellow after another.
If you mean, am I lying in wait for Mr. Cleveland, Madeline said with her father's briskness, you're about as wrong as you can be.
He's a paunchy, pink-haired, freckled man, 10 years older than I am, and personally, I regard him as a snake.
Snakes have the power to hypnotize, dear.
Yes, rabbits and birds. I'm neither.
Rhoda went to a small Chinese Chippendale desk to answer the telephone.
"Oh, hello there," she said. "Where are you?"
"Oh, my God."
"Of course. Yes, naturally. Okay, I'll leave your ticket at the box office."
Yes, they've been here for hours."
"Right. Bye, dear."
She hung up and fluttered her long, pale hands at the company.
"Well, let's drink up. Pug sends his apologies. He's at the White House, and he doesn't know when he can get away."
In Washington, when the absent diner is at the White House, the empty chair is not an embarrassment. Quite the contrary. Nobody asked what Victor Henry was doing at the Executive Mansion, or indeed commented on Rhoda's words. She put Burnwilk on her right and the senator on her left, saying,
"After all these years, protocol still baffles me. How do you choose between a United States senator and a British lord?"
"I'm favoring our foreign guest, Senator."
"Absolutely proper," said Lacouture.
Alastair Tudsbury said,
"Lord Burnwilk will gladly yield you his seat on this occasion, Senator, if he can take yours when Lend-Lease comes to a vote."
"Oh, done!" exclaimed the Air Commodore, whose bemedaled dress uniform dazzled Rhoda.
Everyone laughed, Tudsbury loudest of all. The correspondent's belly shook under a vast expanse of wrinkled waistcoat, spanned by an enormous suspension of gold chain. Rhoda said,
"Well, what good spirits! I was half afraid our English friends would eat Senator Lacouture alive."
The senator wrinkled his eyes.
"You British aren't that hard up for meat yet, are you?"
He added, after the laugh,
"No, seriously, Rhoda, I'm glad you brought us together.
Maybe I've convinced our friends that I'm not a Nazi lover, but just one fellow out of 96, with my own point of view. I certainly don't go for this talk of Senator Wheeler's, that Len Lease will plow under every fourth American boy. That's way out of bounds. But if Roosevelt wants to send England arms free of charge, why the devil doesn't he come out and say so? Instead of giving us all this lend-lease baloney, it insults our intelligence.
I went to a peace rally in New York, Madeline piped up. One speaker told a good story. A tramp stops a rich man on the street. Please, mister, give me a quarter. I'm starving, he says. The rich man says, My dear fellow, I can't give you a quarter. I can lend you or lease you a quarter. Senator LaCouture burst out laughing.
By God, I'll work that into my next speech.
From across the table, Palmer Kirby said, Are you sure you want to draw on a communist source?
Was that one of those commie meetings? Well, a story's a story.
It's so crazy, said Janice. I got stuck in a taxi on Pennsylvania Avenue this afternoon, in front of the White House. We just couldn't move. The newsreel people were there, taking pictures of the pickets. Communists with signs marching round and round in a circle, chanting, The Yanks are not coming. And next to them, a mob of women kneeling and praying, right there on the sidewalk, in the snow. The Christian mothers of America. They'll pray there round the clock, my driver said, until Len Lease is defeated or vetoed. Honestly,